Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable. Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to episode 121 of The Last Round. Thanks again for joining us, guys, whether you're listening for the first time or over 100 times. I know we have technically over 121 episodes, including the bonus episodes, but we appreciate it whether you're on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Boxing Social, wherever you're at, however you're listening, we appreciate it. Dougie Fisher, you're back for what? What number is this? What number is this on the show?
Four?
Is it four? I thought it was. I was telling Mike, I was like, I think it's more than five, but it could be four.
Maybe. You might be right. You might be right. Yeah.
Well, editor-in-chief of The Ring Magazine. I'm sure everybody knows exactly who you are. Dougie Fisher, we appreciate you coming on again, man.
Thanks for having me back.
So you were just in Texas and Dallas, the Dallas area, for the Chocolatito Gonzalez and the Juan Francisco Estrada main event on DAZN.
Had to be there.
Before we kind of jump into that matchup, was this your first fight since the pandemic began last March?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the last time I traveled was to Las Vegas for the Wilder Fury rematch.
So can you, just in before we jump in, like I said, into the fights, tell us about your experience.
Oh, you know, it's totally different now. I mean, I'm used to the bubble because I do work for Thompson Boxing. Without the pandemic, they would be doing a monthly show. Since the pandemic, they got back into it, last summer, and they're kind of going like every other month, that kind of a schedule. But they have a bubble, you know, and it's out there in Corona and, ironic name. Yeah.
Right.
Town, named Corona, and Ken Thompson, the CEO of Thompson Boxing, he owns this gigantic factory, this huge facility, a storage house is what it is, a gigantic storage house for building materials. He owns a building materials company called Omega Products, and they turned it into a studio. No fans or whatever, but there's a nearby hotel. And, you take a COVID test 1 week prior to the show. And then, if that's negative, you report to the site. And the first thing you do, even before you check in, is you take another COVID test. And then you go to your room and you got to stay in your room. And then they usually get the results like later that evening. And if you're negative, then you do the show, which is they're doing a Sunday show. So Saturday and Sunday, you're just in your room. So I'm used to the bubble and having to take tests or whatever, but I hadn't traveled to do it. So, for this show, and it was a matchroom show, I had to send, my negative test results the week of my travel. So I had to time that just right, you know, and I did like a test where they FedExed it to me. And I administered it myself and then put it back in this little box and then FedExed it back. And I just had to keep my fingers crossed that the lab would process it over a weekend and would get it done quick enough. And they did. So my results were ready on Monday. And then I emailed those results to Anthony Lever, the head PR guy with Matchroom. So once I did that, then I'm cleared to get on a plane and head to Dallas. So I flew in on Wednesday, and as soon as I arrived to the host hotel, the Matchroom had a table set up like right behind the front doors, right before you get to the lobby. Actually, they have a desk set up and a table with paperwork, and they're like, you're covering the show, like, yeah, and like, fill out these papers, and you fill these papers out, and they give you a little a wristband. They're like, okay, you're going to check in. Just go to your room. Don't leave your room, and somebody will contact you in regards to your COVID test. I said, okay. So all Wednesday I was in my room, and then like around 8 or 9 o'clock, I'm like, isn't anybody going to give me a call or send me a text to get my test? So I emailed Lever, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, you're going to do your test first thing tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Report to this floor, and we have rapid result testing. We'll have your test result in 15, 20 minutes. So the next morning, you know, Thursday morning, I go to that floor and fill out some more paperwork, and they swab my nose. And literally within 15 minutes, they said, okay, you're negative. And they give you a negative wristband and say, okay, you don't have to stay in your room. You can roam this, you know, the hotel, but we don't have anything going on. You know what I mean? You know, it's like, you know, but you know, you could go to the final press conference, which was that Thursday, and you can go to the weigh-in, you know, and you know, we'll arrange fighter interviews and that kind of stuff if you want to do that face to face. So it was a bit different. It wasn't like being back on the beat, because I think there's still a lot of American boxing writers, especially those who are older, you know, maybe over 40 or over 45 or over 50, that they don't feel safe traveling. And when they heard that Texas was going to lift the mask, you know, not make it mandatory, although everybody had a mask on everywhere I went, at least in Dallas, you know, in the airport and to the hotel, they didn't want to travel for that. So literally there was nobody. The media there, I'd say it was maybe 60-65% from Nicaragua. And then about 20% from Mexico. And then it was like Mexico, you know, US based, you know, Latin media, and then maybe like 5% Japan. From Japan. So they are, you know, like a film crew from Japan. And there were some writers from the LA area who were Japanese, and they were there, maybe about 5 or 6. So it was totally different. And the Nicaragua media, they greeted me like I was the chief, you know. They were like, yo, it's an honor to meet you, and you're my inspiration, and we love that you you've championed Chocolatito for years, blah, 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 blah. And then the Mexican media knew, like, I'm like, they looked at me like Team Chocolatito, and they were kind of cool and kind of, you know, they were respectful, but kind of kept their distance. And the Japanese media, very polite, very quiet. So it didn't feel like the camaraderie wasn't there. You know, there's no Mike Coppinger, there's no Lance Pugmire, no Dan Raphael, no Keith Idick, no Steve Kim, you know, nobody, you know. Even with the ring, the only ring rep that was there was Michael Montero, but he was there as a fan. He was there in the arena. So, yeah, there was just no U.S. representation on site. So it wasn't your usual gossip and catching up, you know, during the press conference. There's no media center or anything like that. So it was kind of weird, you know. And then with Marvin Hagler, his untimely and just shocking out of nowhere passing on Saturday, just a couple hours before the show began, I was in a weird mood. I got to be honest with you. I was, you know, I when I finally got ringside at American Airlines Center, you know, I'm there's just 3 tables that, you know, comprise press row. And it's me and the Nicaraguans in the front row, and the Mexicans in the next row, and the Japanese in the back with a couple reps from Dallas newspapers, you know, who, you know, I don't think they regularly cover boxing. I didn't recognize them.
Right.
It was weird. It was kind of quiet because the Nicaraguan media was nervous. Like, they would, you know, I'd ask them, you know, how do you see the fight? And they're like, you know, it's, you know, Chocolatito's past his prime. You know, they'd say, on record, I'm picking Chocolatito. And I'm like, no, but how do you really feel? You know, what do you really think? And they say, off the record, I think he's going to lose, you know. And some of them are like, I think he's getting knocked out. Like, shh, don't tell anyone I said that. He's getting knocked out. And I talked to a lot of the Mexican press, and they say that's their prediction. He's getting knocked out, you know. I had no problem telling these people, you're completely wrong. You know, it's fine if you pick Estrada, not by knockout. That's not okay. I tell them, like, that ain't happening. They're like, no, but he doesn't seem the same. He doesn't have the same energy. And I'm like, he never has energy. He's always like this. I've never seen him lively at a weigh-in or at a press conference. Usually, especially back, before his first loss, he was always draining himself to make weight, whether it was flyweight or super bantamweight or, definitely junior flyweight. When it came time for fight week, he didn't have any energy to give, really. But then his personality, he's soft-spoken. He's humble, and he means it. It's genuine. And he's just not a loquacious individual. He doesn't have that type of charisma. He's not dynamic outside of the ring. Inside of the ring, he's a beast, and he's a marvel, a freak of nature, really. But outside of the ring, he's just this little guy. And that's all there is to it. And you can't judge him by his persona or, his aura or however you want to put that. But there was this weird, and I think some of it is political. I think it's gotten to a point in his country where, some of the media, they're not afraid to kind of criticize him because he supports the government there. And that's a very polarizing thing. I could kind of tell some of the folks that were saying, no, I got a feeling he's going to lose this fight and he's going to lose big. Like they were on the other side of the political spectrum in Nicaragua. And I think that was part of it. I don't know for sure. They didn't come out and say that, but they did talk about that. They did talk about that, he's not universally beloved in Nicaragua because of his political affiliation or his support of that government. So I didn't care. I'm like, politics are out of it.
Yeah.
When they step in that ring, it's whoever the better man is, that's who's going to win if our judges know what they're looking at. So.
Speaking of, the winner, El Gallo Estrada actually won by split decision.
Yeah.
Controversial, at least according to.
By the way, hats off to him. Estrada's a badass, man. That dude is an elite fighter. He's just. Listen, had Chocolatito actually been shot, or not feeling it, he would have decisively beat Chocolatito. What I mean? I mean, the effort he gave against Chocolatito, that beats most junior bantamweights. And junior bantamweight might be the deepest division, might be the most experienced and talented division in all of boxing. No disrespect to Ioka or Sorungvisai. That was an amazing effort. But in my opinion, Chocolatito's effort was that much better. Just a little bit better. Yeah.
So Estrada is now the WBC and WBA, super flyweight world champion.
Don't leave out Ring Magazine, man. Look who you're talking.
Before you came on here, Mike, I swear to God, he just said this right before you jumped on. He was like, was this for the ring title too? Because Mike was trying to find some photos with the ring belt. We couldn't find any.
Estrada didn't bring his belt.
Sometimes
they leave their belt. I don't know why they do that, but they shouldn't. Okay. A ring champ shouldn't do that.
Yeah, because
strip them of the title. It's like, oh, that's on the line, bro.
Okay, so it was for the ring title. We assumed it was. We didn't see the belt. We just saw the WBC and WBA belts.
But you know what? Kudos to DAZN and Matchroom. And Eddie Hearn, because they made sure to put that on all of the promotional materials, on all of the posters, on all of the press releases, any sort of graphic. They did. They took photos there. Ed Mulholland, who works for Matchroom, he's the head photographer. They did these studio photos for, just the promotional, the shoulder programming and all. And whoever was a ring champ, they made sure they had a belt. So Estrada didn't bring his belt, but they had Hiroto Kiyoguchi loan his belt just for the shoot. Yeah. So he would actually have, he would have his green WBC belt and the Ring Magazine title. So, Estrada's images that went out from fight week, he had his belt or whatever. But on fight night, no. Kiyoguchi was definitely going to have his own belt. He wasn't going to loan his belt for Estrada on fight night. But yeah, definitely Estrada's Ring Magazine champion. We're proud of him. He deserves that title, being Ring Magazine champion, and he deserves to be in Ring Magazine's pound for pound top 10.
So as I mentioned, Dougie, this was obviously a controversial decision, at least according to to many boxing fans and media. What was your immediate reaction when you heard the decision for Estrada?
I hated that 117-111 card. Just ruined it. It's like boxing gets it right. Rarely do you have the two best in a division who are going to give their all and deliver a sensational fight. Like we had a couple years ago with Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez, right? With Golovkin, we had the consensus choice as the number one middleweight in against the biggest star. You know, finally the biggest star in boxing decides, okay, I'm going to be a full-fledged middleweight. I'm going to fight at middleweight. It's not going to be at 155. It's not going to be a couple pounds over 160, you know, like his fight with Chavez Jr. It's going to be at 160, no rehydration clauses, no nothing like that, right? And a bunch of belts are going to be on the line, as well as the Ring Magazine Championship, which Canelo had at the time, actually. So it was like, okay, we got it right. They were respectful the whole time. It was it did like a record gate, I think, like maybe the third biggest gate in Nevada State history, something like $30+ million gate at the T-Mobile Arena. Kazakhstan fans flew in. I'd never seen that many natives of Kazakhstan in one place for a fight. The Mexican fans showed up, of course, and there were Mexicans for Golovkin, and there were just a lot of hardcore fans from around the country, around the world. It was an excellent fight, but Golovkin was a little bit better. You know what I mean? And he deserved to win that. And he had to settle for a draw, which wouldn't have been such a hard pill to swallow. But Adelaide Bird's scorecard of 118-110 just took a piss, just took a big greasy dump over that entire event. And it sucks because everyone got it right. Mm-hmm. Like everyone did their part. You know, the promoters did, Tom Loeffler did, and Golden Boy Promotions did, and HBO did. Everybody did their part, and the fans showed up, and the fighters got in the ring, and they gave us a really good fight. I mean, it was a special fight. And this one scorecard screwed it up, and that's how I felt with this Sucre guy, who I'd never heard of, by the way. I'd never heard of this judge before. Bird unheard of. Bird had a bit of a reputation. You know, they should have known with her. But this Sucre guy, I didn't know. I never heard of him until I heard that scorecard. And I was like, great. This is unfair to Chocolatito and to Estrada. Because the way fight fans are, they're going to be mad at Estrada for it. And then Chocolatito fans who really believe that he won. You know, and there's some folks who scored this, you know, as much as 116, 112 for Chocolatito. Which I can see. I didn't have it that wide. I had it 115, 113, 7 rounds to 5 for Roman Gonzalez. But there are fans who say, no. They're like, no, Chocolatito won this clearly. And now I see them. They're going after Estrada fans, and they're beefing on social media and comment spaces and in YouTube videos and all that. And, you know, I think a big reason is because of that scorecard. That scorecard is so unfair that they're pissed off. That it just looks corrupt. It looks awful. The look is really bad. Boxing's got to figure out what to do about this. I mean, here's how I'll sum it up this way. When you have the best, so Chocolatito, there's no doubt in anybody's mind he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He was years ago, you know, going back to 2016, whenever he beat Carlos Quadras, as soon as he was a four division champion, like first ballot Hall of Famer, man, you're in. And everything he's done from that point on is just icing on the cake, right? It's just building towards like legitimate all-time greatness, right? In Estrada, like we've already established, he's a real champion, a legit champion, and a legit pound-for-pound player. He's an elite boxer talent, right? When you have the best against the best, it should only be the best referee. It should only be the best, most experienced judges. You have the most experienced fighters. Why wouldn't you have? And you have a fighter like Estrada or Chocolatito with that level of experience and the level of competition that they've faced, they're complete fighters, which means they do everything in there. Like Chocolatito is not just a pressure fighter. It's not just about volume punching. It's like every punch has a purpose. Every punch leads to the next punch, the combinations that he drops, what he does on the inside his footwork. There's a lot going on. So you have to be an experienced judge to get to process all that, to see all of that. You got to, it's got to be the best. And I don't understand why commissions, I don't understand why commissions don't understand that. Like, okay, for like the prelim bouts, assign whoever or whatever, you know what I mean? For a 10 rounder, assign just a solid guy or whatever, you know? But for your true championship bouts, where you're talking about guys who are one day going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, you know what? If you have a Hall of Fame official, that's who you assign to it. Hall of Famers should judge Hall of Famers. It should be the best officiating and judging the best when they step into the ring. And it's really rare. So just do it on this occasion. Bite the damn bullet, man. Don't play politics. Give us the best officials when the best fighters face each other. Because it only happens four or five times a year if we're lucky. Give us the damn best, man. Give us the best referees and judges that you possibly can. Because the best fighters are going to have tight fights. When you match the best against the best, it's going to be hotly contested. And they're going to make adjustments. And there's going to be ebbs and flows. You got to have the utmost concentration. And you got to have knowledge. And you got to have experience. And you got to know what you're looking at. And I don't understand why the commissions haven't figured this out. And I don't understand why promoters don't look at who the assigned judges are and say, hey, I never heard of this guy. I never heard of this lady. Who is she? Why? This is the best matchup we've ever made. I'm, as a promoter, I'm proud of this matchup. Nobody else could have got it done but me. You know how hard I had to work, how many egos I had to smooth over. You know how much money I had to dole out to make this happen. It's like, I want the best. Like they should, like the promoter or the management of the fighter should be like, yeah, you know, we're looking at this referee and you know what, he just started refereeing world title bouts 5 years ago. Nah, bro. Nah, we need a veteran. We need a veteran. These guys didn't just turn pro 5 years ago. You know what I mean? Or looking at the judges being like, who is this? You know, and then going to Box Rec and looking them up and like, oh, this person's had some funny decisions, you know, whatever, Googling their name, you know, with controversy and see what pops up, you know, and be like, yeah, I don't know. This person's kind of sus. You know what that means, Commissioner? Sus. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know why. I don't know why that doesn't happen more often, but it's, I mean, apart from, you know, serious injuries, you know, ring fatalities and just the best fights not happening, the worst thing about boxing, professional boxing, is poor officiating, poor scorecards, you know, or, you know, a referee missing a knockdown or missing how a cut was opened on a fighter, not knowing if it was a headbutt or a punch. And even with, you know, instant replay, still not getting it right. Like, those are the worst things, you know, apart from serious injuries and just the best fights not happening. That's the worst thing about professional boxing. That turns off fans more than anything.
Do you think the sentiment would have been different if that 117-111 scorecard was 115-113 for Estrada?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because that acknowledges what everybody saw, that it was hotly contested. It was nip and tuck. And there were rounds. That's why I don't get crazy, because I scored it 7-5, right? So first round gave it to Estrada. So Clotito was taking his time, taking steps back, taking his opponent's measure, you know, figuring out, okay, let me gauge this man's energy. And Estrada started hot, right? I could tell Estrada's like, no, I'm going to get this knockout. Because usually every punch doesn't have that much mustard on it. And so he started hot and he was throwing heat from the get-go. So I was like, okay, he wants to get a knockout. All right, good luck to you. Let's see what happens. I like that. I like that energy. Keep it. He did keep it, you know. But guess what? Chocolatito started punching him back in the second round. I scored the second round for Chocolatito. But Chocolatito, even in the second round, maybe the first minute, he was still kind of, he wasn't punching back. You know, mid-round, he started to turn it on. And I thought there were some nice, clean right hands from the outside. I'm like, ooh. Chocolatito edged it. But I put, you know, on my scorecard, I write down, you know, I write down tit for tat, G right hand. That's Gonzalez right hand, you know, and then I note Chance of Mexico, Gallo, you know, so the crowd was pro Estrada. Maybe that had an impact on the judges. I don't know. It shouldn't. If you're a professional, it shouldn't. The crowd shouldn't sway you like that. But I put down tit for tat, right? I mean, it was like an even round. Like, I wouldn't be mad if that round went to Estrada. That wouldn't be out of line, right? So automatically, my scorecard goes from 115, 113 to a draw, right? And there was another round. There was, you know, I thought that, you know, the sixth round was awesome. That was just hot. That was like a round of the year candidate. I just wrote close. I wrote down G for Gonzalez. I scored it for Gonzalez, but I put close. They both put it on each other. If that round goes to Estrada, I'm not mad. You know what I mean? So there's a swing there. You know what I mean? And then there were rounds that I scored for Estrada, right? The 11th round, again, I wrote down, all I wrote in my notes right here was, because I'm watching the damn fight. I'm not writing down notes and stuff. I'm paying close attention because so much is happening. These guys are making split second adjustments on the fly as their punches are going. They're doing little things to block punches, to parry punches, to counter punches, to switch up their attack, to fake the other man out. This is like that was boxing on the highest level, right? So I'm watching. I'm not tweeting like crazy, you know, other than right after the round. I'm like, breathtaking. Oh, my God. You know, that's it. And I get right back. Yeah, that's between rounds. You know, I'm not tweeting during the round. I really was watching this fight, you know. So after the 11th round, I just wrote down E. And then I wrote down tit for tat in parentheses close. I had it for Estrada. 11th round could have easily gone to Gonzalez. It easily could have gone to Chocolatito. So it was that kind of fight. So there was like some swing rounds. You know, if you got more than one swing round and everybody has it close, then it's okay. You don't get too pissed. You're still upset if you really feel your guy won, but he didn't get the decision. And I felt, I'll be honest. I mean, I don't make any bones about it. I lay it out there. I'm a Chocolatito guy. I'm a fan. I'm not just a member of the media. Can I curse?
Yeah.
I'm a fucking fan. And guys like Chocolatito don't come around often. I can tell you, they just don't. And usually with those weight classes, straw weight through superfly, they burn out by their late 20s. They're done. They're done by 30, 31, right? Especially if they have more than 50 fights like he does. Especially if they have that style that's hard pressure and volume punching like that. By the time they're 33 and they've been in some of the wars that Chocolatito has been in, it's over. They're done. They might stick around, but they're not going to be able to summon a Herculean effort, a superhuman effort like Chocolatito did. And especially like, you know, I'm going into the 12th round. I'm like, this is anybody's fight, right? I thought Chocolatito won it. You know what I mean? And you know, CompuBox says he threw 158 punches and landed more than 50 of them. Like, damn. And I thought maybe one or two of those right hands in the final minute might have stunned Estrada, you know? So I'm looking at the effective punching. Both went crazy. But a guy gives that kind of effort and you don't know if he can go to the well like that again because, you know, he's been world class for, you know, since 2008. You know what I mean? And he's a lighter weight class fighter. It's like, man, that sucks. He may never be able to summon that type of effort again. And they, you know, and they're like, yeah, we're going to give it to him. You know, it's just like, I don't know. It's frustrating. That is frustrating. But have the other two cards been, you know, 115, 113, or even like 115, 114, like they had an even round in there? That I can understand, you know. That's a pill to swallow, but you can swallow it. But when one of the scorecards is 117, 111, that's hard to swallow. It really is. And it makes me mad because I feel like everybody should be talking about what a great fight it was and what an amazing effort and what an amazing level of craft both fighters displayed for 12 rounds. They didn't half-ass it for 12 freaking rounds. You know, they closed the show. They emptied the tank. All those cliches, they dug deep. All the stuff that we want to see from championship boxing, they gave us they deserve that. You know, they deserve the attention. They deserve all the praise. We shouldn't have, we shouldn't be spending, there shouldn't be any energy spent on a screwed up scorecard. There shouldn't be, but there is, you know? So that's, that just pissed me off. That was just like everything. It's like just getting everything right, like a perfect dinner or whatever. And the waiter sneezes in it right before he, just, you know, he serves it. I'm like, damn, you got, you know, we got the right, we got everybody together. We ordered all the right food. The mood is right. Everything is just perfect. This looks delicious. It smells delicious. And then somebody screws it up. You know what I mean? This person, you know, the cooks did their best. You know, the cooks delivered. And then this dude ruins it, you know, whatever. That's like the fly in the soup, you know. It's just like, damn, man. Almost got it right. It was almost a perfect night. Almost.
So they have now split two. Chocolatito won the first one in 2012, and now Estrada gets the W this past Saturday. Do we see the trilogy, Dougie?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, these guys don't make money like the welterweights do or the middleweights do, certainly the heavyweights. They don't make money. They don't get paid a lot. They're great value for promoters, programmers, for networks. Because here's the thing, they will fight each other. You know, hard up fanboys can look at these emerging lightweights who do have talent. They do have star potential, you know, Teofimo Lopez and Ryan Garcia and Tank Davis and Devin Haney, and they could say, ooh, you know, the four kings, the next four kings. No, like, don't even say that. They have to fight each other first. Like, at least two of these guys got to share the ring before we start comparing them to Hagler, Hearns, Duran, and Leonard, right? But Chocolatito, Estrada, Sor Rungvisai, and Carlos Cuadras, they've all fought each other. Mm-hmm. They've all fought each other twice. They get it on. So these little guys, they get it on, and they have a great cast of supporting characters, if you will, you know, from Ioka to Donnie Nietes, who's been missing in action, to the guy that Ioka just beat, Tanaka. You know, Kosei Tanaka is a welcome addition to 115. You got Joshua Franco and Andrew Maloney, and Cuadras is still around, you know what I mean? McWilliams Arroyo, although he's fighting at flyweight now, but if you look at his record, he's been willing to mix with these dudes. He's fought all these guys, you know what I mean? Or most of these guys. So you have, you know, you can actually have a round robin. You can basically have a tournament without actually having an official tournament, because these guys want to face each other. And if they're going to make the big money, they have to face each other. So yeah, definitely. I think it's going to happen. Will it happen immediately? I don't think it's going to be an immediate rematch. I think Chocolatito is going to take some time off. He certainly earned it. Estrada has a WBC mandatory. You know, he didn't bring the Ring magazine into the ring, but he did not forget the WBC title. So he got that in there. He's Mexican. This is a Mexico City-based organization. They ride for the Mexicans. So they say Sri Saket Sor Rungvisai is the mandatory. And he was supposed to get a shot at Estrada before Chocolatito. And they worked out a deal. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Team Sor Rungvisai is going to take another step aside. They're not going to, even if it involves money, I don't think they're going to do it. They want that crack at the green belt. And I'm sure as a competitor, Sor Rungvisai wants another shot at Estrada. Cause I, you know, whether he'll admit it or not, in his heart of hearts, he's got to be mad at himself for fighting most of that rematch orthodox. That was bizarre. That was so weird. Like, bro. And adding insult to injury, salt to the wound, when he switched back to southpaw late in the fight, he had success. Just like, you're an idiot, my man. I don't know what you were thinking, but whatever. So I'm sure he's like, okay, mindset for this rubber match, southpaw. I'm just doing it southpaw. And he looked pretty sharp in that stay busy tune-up fight, that step-aside fight on Friday. He looked sharp. He wasn't in with like a world beater, but he looked good. His body looked good. He looked sharp. His technique looked good. The power looked good. you know, just walked the dude down and just landed hard shots to the body and head. You know, so he's still the Rat King. He's not the king. He's not Chocolatito, but he's the Rat King.
Right.
And I think he's going to demand that he gets that shot. So Estrada's going to have to defend against him probably sometime in the summer. And then maybe in the fall, Estrada and Chocolatito do it again, when hopefully, fingers crossed, pandemic restrictions are opened up in most major arenas and most major markets can at least be like 80% capacity. And if that's the case, I know Eddie Hearn wants to bring it to the Los Angeles area.
Oh, yes.
Makes sense, because the fans didn't show up. You know, I mean, they had to be socially distanced in Dallas, but they still, it wasn't to whatever the capacity was set to, whatever it was configured to, it wasn't to its capacity. But, you know, had that fight taken place without COVID restrictions at the Forum in Inglewood, they would have done 16,000, you know, or the Staples Center, they would have done, you know, 16, 17. They may not have sold out Staples Center, but they would have come close to 20,000. I think they would have done like 17,000. Certainly StubHub Center, what is it called? Dignity
Park, Health.
Dignity Health Sports Park, that would be sold out. They'd definitely do 8,000. They'd have some overflow there, and maybe they could set up bleachers around the edges and get like 9,000 in there. I think they would do that. And the energy would be off the chain. Mm. You know what I mean? The Mexican fans would show up. LA doesn't have a huge base of Nicaraguans, but Nicaraguans would show up. And definitely hardcore fans, just fans, you know, fans of both fighters would show up for that fight. And they make a lot of noise. And the effort that those guys gave in Dallas on Saturday, that's the kind of effort that just that makes people stand up and spill their beer. And whoever gets spilled on doesn't even care. They're so into the fight. Somebody gets popcorn spilled on them. I don't care. You know, it's that kind of fight, you know. And I get the feeling whenever these guys share the ring, they're going to give whatever they have, you know. Hopefully they still have it to deliver a rubber match. If they can deliver a rubber match that lives up to the first two fights, that's one of the all-time great trilogies. Mm. Seriously, that's up there. That's up there with Bo Holyfield and Zale Graziano and, Ali Frazier. It's not blasphemous to say that, you know, and I feel privileged. I was live. I was there at both fights. One of the few American sports writers that were actually at both fights.
Also on that DAZN card, Dougie, you know, a recent signing to Canelo's new management team, Hiroti Kiyoguchi or Kiyoguchi, I hope I'm saying that right, remains undefeated. How do you say it?
Said
it
right. Yeah, you say it real quick, the Kyo.
I think it's Kiyoguchi.
The same character, you know, the city Kyoto?
Right.
The city called Kyoto?
Right.
So his name, it has the same character as that city. So you would say Kiyoguchi.
I believe so, yeah.
It's going to blend in, Kyoguchi.
So
Bad boy.
Right. He retains his WBA and Ring Magazine light flyweight.
Yeah, you got
world
it.
World titles.
Yeah.
After an unfortunate hand injury to his opponent, Axel Aragon Vega. I mean, you were right there ringside, Dougie. What'd you think when that hand injury happened to Vega?
It was out of nowhere. And I thought Vega was coming on. I thought Kiyoguchi was fighting the wrong fight. And I know how he is. He likes body shots and he likes the left uppercut. And he studied great fighters like Alexis Arguello and Chocolatito. He studied tape of them. He's studied footage of them. And he tries to emulate that in training, in sparring, and obviously in the ring. So he was trying to land those punches. Those are his pet punches. Left hook to the liver, left uppercut, right uppercut. He likes his body shots and he likes his infighting. But by fighting on the inside against a guy that small, he was giving that guy his only chance of landing shots. And Vega was getting those overhand rights in, and he was physically strong. I like the little man, the little dude, El Mini, is that his nickname?
4'10", I think. Yeah.
I think maybe shorter, like maybe
four shorter than that?
9.5. He's tiny, dude. He is a little dude, but
he can fight.
He can really fight. Yeah. I looked at his record, and his last two losses was against a really good Puerto Rican fighter who's highly rated in Ring Magazine's straw rankings. And so his last loss was a technical decision loss to this dude in Puerto Rico. So he's traveled before. He's been in with world-class opposition, and he was definitely motivated. And I thought he gave just as good as he got. They were going, it was tit for tat. Good. It was fun. It was a fun fight. And, you know, Kyoguchi's not a tall guy, but he towered over this dude. But I thought he needed to kind of establish some distance, get a jab going, maneuver around him, and pick his spots when to engage on the inside. But instead, it was mainly trench warfare, which suited Vega. So I thought Vega was doing well, and I thought he was coming on, actually, right when he hurt his hand. And it happened so quick. He hurt his hand. He turned his back. He headed towards the ropes, and Kyoguchi jumped right on him. Nailed him once, and the referee, I think it was Raul Cais Jr., he recognized it right away that it was a serious injury, and he halted it. But it was confusing at ringside. You're like, what happened? I thought maybe a low blow or, you know, something like that, you know. But then immediately after, he was shaking his hand, and you're like, okay, he hurt his hand. And he may have broke it. I don't know if that was confirmed. They were saying that, though, in the arena that night, like, maybe, you know, half an hour later, they were saying that the hand was broken.
Dougie, being a boxing historian, is there any truth behind if Vega had won, he would have been the shortest champion ever?
I think so. I think baby Jake Madlatla from South Africa is the shortest world champion, major world title holder ever. And I think he was 4'10". So I never seen baby Jake Madlatla fight live, but this dude seems shorter than Vega. So...
And I also saw a quick fact from one of our previous guests in front of the show, Dan Canobio of CompuBox. I think he also mentioned that Vega would have been the first world champion in the sport of boxing to be born in the 2000s. I think that's also true.
Oh, really? Yeah, because he's just 20.
He's only 20.
Young. Yeah, no, yeah. He's got some good experience under his belt. I want to see him back. You know, if 105 is more natural for him, then – you know, go ahead and go back down there. But if he wants to stick around at 108, I love this division. It's not as deep as junior bantamweight 115, but it's got a lot of fun players. So you got Kyoguchi, you got Kinshiro Taraji, you know, the dynamic duo from Japan. You got Felix Alvarado from Nicaragua, tall, rangy, heavy hands, really game, very experienced. You have Elwin Soto, who's the WBO title holder.
Heavy-handed.
I think he's at least co-promoted by Golden Boy. He fights on DAZN. Mm-hmm. I've called one or two of his fights. He's a lot of fun. I think, you know what? I think Elwin Soto, because he's a short dude. Mm-hmm. Short, stocky, aggressive guy. Elwin Soto versus Axel Vega. That's a hell of a, all, you know, Mexico Civil War, man, right there. That would be fun. But Vega would be fun to, you know, against any of these dudes. And there's some good contenders too. I mean, it's not just the title holders at 108. They're, and like I was saying about the junior bantamweights, these little guys, they don't make a lot of money. They don't make $1 million purses.
Right.
So if they're going to make like a solid, you know, if they're going to make $100,000 even, you know, they got to fight top contenders. They got to fight each other, the top dogs. So the fights can be made, and it's good. Like I say, it's good value, you know,
right.
Even if you've never heard of them, if you put them in like a co-feature to a fight with big names, it just sort of sets the table. You know, whoever tunes in right before the main event, they're going to be entertained by the little guys. And maybe they become hardcore fans, or maybe they make note. Okay, this guy Vega, I like this little guy. Mm-hmm. It's like the Energizer Bunny. You know what I mean? And they tune in next time. You know, and so they can build up the viewership, and those fighters can build up their fan bases. But I know they're not expensive. I know this.
Right. Also on Saturday in a Showtime card in Connecticut, the Mohegan Sun Casino, David Benavidez got the 11th round TKO over Ronald Ellis. Obviously, you were at the DAZN card, so you
obviously but I watched it. I watched the replay. Yeah.
Right. So what'd you think about Benavidez's performance and what's next for him?
I mean, no disrespect to Ronald Ellis. I like him. He's a real nice dude, real cool cat. But I mean, he's Canelo's sparring partner. You know what I mean? He's not well rated. He's not like, you know, if you go to Ring Magazine and look at our super middleweight top 10, you'll see David Benavidez is number one. You won't see Ronald Ellis's name, which doesn't mean he can't be ranked one day. You know, he's 31. He's getting up there in age, but, you know, he can still do something. I thought Ellis showed me a lot. He's actually a better boxer than I thought he was. Got better lateral movement and footwork than I thought he had. But, you know, I think the victory for Benavidez is that he had a long camp, did a lot of media, did a lot of interviews, and he talks a great game. And I like it because I know he's not just talking. He means it. He really does want to fight everybody. He's got that mean streak when he's in the ring, and he can take guys out quick, but he takes his time. He doesn't mind administering what we would call back in Missouri a slow bleed and just slowly grind people down and just beat the crap out of them. And his body looked good. He made weight. That was the second victory. So having that long camp, actually making 168 pounds, his body looked slimmed down, didn't look like he gained too much weight. I know he has the physiology to do that, to put on a crazy amount of weight. Like, you know, if you told me that, he put on, 185, he was a 185 on fight night for some of his previous bouts, I wouldn't doubt it. You know what I mean? Like, he could put on a lot of weight. So it didn't look like he did. His hand speed was there. The jab was there. The punch selection was there. When he put the punches together, it was rapid succession. So he looked good. He didn't. I'll say this. I wasn't in awe of his performance. It was workmanlike. That's how I would describe it. He didn't look like a world beater. He wasn't in with a world beater, and he didn't look like a world beater. I mean, he looked like, if you removed Ellis and put Canelo in place of Ellis, you're seeing where Canelo would have, got to the body, landed uppercuts, beat him to the jab, counterpunched him here, that's a game that fans do. I mean, obviously it would be a different version of Benavidez. You fight Canelo, you would be up for it. I have to imagine. It was workmanlike. He got rounds in. It probably shouldn't have gone to the 11th round because Alice took a lot of hard shots for a number of rounds, especially over the second half. But I think it was good. I think it was good for Benavidez to have a long camp, to prove to himself that he can make 168 and be healthy and fight healthy and look sharp and go rounds. I think it was all good for him. The challenge now will be for him to get a significant fight. And not lay out for the next 6 months. He's 24 years old. He needs to fight more often than he does. And that's all there is to it. Pandemic or not, these young guys have to take advantage of their prime.
Right.
And that's the main reason when people ask, I've seen on social media, people say, Canelo just went to the 168 pound division because it's not as deep as middleweight, or there's no talent there. And I disagree. I think Benavidez is marvelously talented. I think Caleb Plant is marvelously talented. Terrific athlete. I think Billy Joe Saunders is as natural a boxer as you're going to find. That dude is relaxed, and he knows what he's doing in there. These guys all have the potential to be world beaters at their weight class. And honestly, if you take the best middleweights, including Golovkin and Jermall Charlo, and you say, okay, go up to 168 and fight one of those three guys, I think a lot of people would pick the super middleweights. Not everybody, but a lot of people. I think opinion would be split. I don't think people would look at that as like easy work. Even for a talent like Jermall Charlo, if he stepped up to 168 to fight Caleb Plant or Saunders or David Benavidez, I don't think people would be, oh, easy work, man. Oh, this is easy for Charlo. The super middleweights are easy. No. These guys can fight. I will not pick any of them to beat Canelo for one reason. They don't fight enough. They have been on a once or twice a year fight schedule for a couple years now. And in the case of Billy Joe Saunders, more than a few years. Mm-hmm. In several years that he's been, I think since 2015, he's fought once or twice a year. And Benavidez, when I look at how long he's been a pro, because he's a young guy, but he turned pro at 17.
Right.
This dude's been a pro for 8 years. he just fought his 24th pro fight. Now, to put this in some perspective here, when James Toney fought Michael Nunn in 1991, summer of 1991, he had only been a pro for 2 years and some change. Mm-hmm. He turned pro late 1989. And then he fought, you boys and girls at home, go check out Box Rec. But I think in 1990 and 1991, he fought 22 times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So he was ready. He had 20, he was 24-0 when he faced Michael Nunn. But he was ready for anything because that dude was fighting, and he was fighting tough guys too. And he fought earlier in 91. Oh, I'm sorry, I messed up. He turned pro in late 1988, and in 89 and 1990, he had fought like 22 times or something like that, 21, 22 times or whatever. Anyways, at the start of 91, he fights Murky Sosa, and it's a tough fight. And I think it's on ESPN, and he wins by split decision. So it was a tight fight, right? And so I think, you know, Team Nunn, you know, are saying, okay, he's ranked by the IBF. Let's fight this guy. You know, he's got an unbeaten record. He talks a good game. Let's fight him. And, you know, I think they thought it was a homecoming for Michael Nunn. He was fighting in Davenport, Iowa. And James was ready, though. James was ready because of that repetition, because – he was fighting tough guys. He was fighting tough journeymen and gatekeepers and fellow prospects like Sosa. He was ready for it. When his moment came, he was ready for it. And I just wonder with these guys and these young dudes, you know, like Benavidez and like Plant, are they going to be ready for the big moment? Are they active enough? And are they fighting tough enough guys to be ready for what Canelo is going to offer them? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I'm not saying they won't compete. I'm not saying they're not going to go in there and give it their all and be 100% in, you know, in shape, you know, physical condition, but are they going to be mentally ready? You know, are they going to have the experience, you know, to deal with Canelo? Because Canelo is 30 years old, but he has the experience of a 40-year-old.
Right. Before we let you go, Dougie, we know you had a prior commitment upcoming here later tonight, so we definitely appreciate your time here on the Last Round. Big fight this weekend. To me, it's a very intriguing fight. The biggest fight of Virgil Ortiz Jr.'s career so far, as he goes up against Maurice Hooker for the vacant WBO International Welterweight title on DAZN. Tell us what you think about this matchup.
Well, it's, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, no, he has fought a former title holder before, but that guy, I think it was Juan Carlos Salgado, and Salgado's title was at 130, right?
Yeah, you're right.
So
yeah.
Salgado was fighting 10 pounds over his prime weight when he faced Virgil Ortiz and Ortiz's 9th or 10th pro bout, right? And Ortiz at that time was a big junior welterweight. Now he's a good-sized welterweight, and he's fighting a former world title holder at 140 pounds. In Maurice Hooker, he's fighting someone who's taller than him, rangier than he is, somebody who outgrew the 140-pound division. So Hooker should feel better fighting at welterweight. He's definitely got the experience. I've got a lot of respect for Maurice Hooker because he's that rare fighter, that rare American fighter that traveled overseas to win his world title. And he went to Manchester, England to fight Terry Flanagan when Flanagan was undefeated. And he beat fair and square. He beat Flanagan to win that WBO title. And then in his first title defense, he goes to Oklahoma City to fight a then unbeaten Saucedo, Alex Saucedo. And Oklahoma was at least the home state, but I think Oklahoma City was the hometown of Saucedo. So he was going into the lion's den for his, you know, his first two title bouts. And he came out victorious. He got dropped against Salcedo, but he got up, acquitted himself well, and got the stoppage. So I got respect for guys like that who are going to travel and be in the other guy's hometown. He's a good boxer, a decent puncher. But I do think that Ortiz is special, and he's on a mission, and it's going to be search and destroy. And as you guys know, his trainer, Ortiz's trainer is Robert Garcia. And Garcia also trains Jose Ramirez, who's, you know, the only guy to beat Hooker. And he stopped right. Hooker. And how did he do it? It was pressure. It was get inside. You know, like I said, Hooker, I think his wingspan is like 80 inches. It's yeah, crazy. Big. It's like a light heavyweight's wingspan. So obviously it makes sense. And Garcia wants his fighters to get in close, pull him to the ropes, work over his body, head, beat up his arms. And I think, you know, Ortiz doesn't have the experience of Ramirez, but he's very talented. He does have really good technique. And I do think he hits harder than Ramirez does. I've watched Ortiz train, and he's one of these dudes where he does load up with a lot of his shots. Every shot is hard. He's looking for maximum leverage, and you can tell, I see it on his face, man. He's grunting. He's wanting to do damage, right?
Yeah.
But he retains that power. I've watched him, you know, train, you know, doing mitts and working bags like 30 plus rounds, man. They're all hard. Like the power doesn't drop off, you know? So
right.
He's one of them dudes, man. So I think he's going to break Hooker down like to a mid round stoppage, maybe six or seven rounds. I'm thinking if Hooker can take him past seven rounds, I think it'll be interesting. He's never been past seven rounds.
Right.
But I just think going that many rounds with Ortiz, you're going to sustain some serious damage. So it's imperative for Hooker to earn some respect early.
Right.
Got to do like Oscar Valdez did against Miguel Burchelt. You got to hit him hard early. It's, you know, you can box. It's okay to box, but you got to get that respect. You don't necessarily have to score a knockdown, but you got to hurt him. You know, you got to make him back off a little bit and be a little bit leery about crowding you.
Right.
So that's a tough task for Hooker, but this is a legitimate step up. And I'm very high on Virgil Ortiz, as are most fans and media, and I expect him to shine.
Some parting words for the unfortunate passing of Marvelous Marvin Hagler before we let you go here, Dougie.
Yeah, Hagler was one of those dudes like a Larry Holmes that I gained an appreciation for after their title run. When, you know, I wasn't a hardcore fan when they were in their primes. You know, I'm born in 1970. And my introduction to boxing is Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard. So I was attracted to these flamboyant, charismatic, dynamic personalities who were also dynamic in the ring, especially Ray Leonard. When I saw Hagler for the first time, he looked kind of just ordinary to me, plodding. Just a methodical stalking technician. I had respect for him because everybody else had respect for Hagler, but people weren't. It was just like, you know, hardcore fans that were like really appreciated Hagler. Hardcore fans and New England area fans. He was a regional attraction. He didn't cross over. He's a hard man. He was a hard man and a blue collar champion. And it was a hard road. That's why he was a hard guy. He was a bit jaded on the business of boxing because you're talking about a guy who was really in his prime in the late 70s. He was ready to fight and beat anybody in 1977 and 1978 and 1979. And, you know, Rodrigo Valdez didn't fight him. And Hugo Coro didn't fight him. And Vito Antuofermo finally, late in 1979, gave him that title shot. And I think it was forced, you know, quite frankly, but Hagler should have won a 15 round decision and he had to settle for a draw. So he had to travel to England to, you know, for a second title shot when he won the title and he wins it. And he had more than 50 pro fights by that time. I think he had like 53 pro fights, you know, by the time he finally wins this title. And he's in enemy territory and people are booing him and rioting and throwing bottles. And you can understand why maybe he's a little bit jaded on the game. You know what I mean? That, but because of that, once he won that title and there, that's it. He was undisputed. There was nobody else. You know, my teenage years, there was only one middleweight champion and that was Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And he turned back challenge after challenge after challenge. Thankfully, Roberto Duran enabled him to have like a star-studded event, something that attracted the attention of the mainstream media. Unfortunately for him, Durant is a once-in-a-lifetime talent and took him 15 rounds, and people were like, you're fighting a lightweight. Why didn't you knock him out, you know, Marvin? It's a, you know, some people were kind of critical of him. I know I remember reading in the boxing magazines, they either said that Hadley was overrated or that he gave Durant too much respect. But, you know, that wasn't the case. It was just two great fighters fighting each other, and it was a tactical bout. But it wasn't until 85 that shootout, that epic shootout with Thomas Hearns, where casual fans are like, wow, Marvin Hagler, dude, where's this guy been, man? Yeah. This is amazing. And obviously, you know, that fight and then the battle of attrition with John the Beast Mugabe, you know, this coaxes Sugar Ray Leonard, my boyhood idol, out of retirement, and really got me into watching, back into boxing, to where I'm watching it and I'm reading about boxing and everything. And I think that fight, that event, made a lot of fans. And Marvin was special because he arguably won the fight. He didn't get the decision, right? And there was that one awful card, you know, Jojo Guevara. And Marvin said, you know, okay, thank you, boxing, I'm out of here. And he left on his own terms. You know, he was on top of the middleweight mountain, and nobody really pushed him off. He left on his own accord, on his own terms, and he kept his dignity. And he was always classy in retirement, but, you know, he was kind of, I wouldn't say reclusive, but he was a private citizen, you know what I mean? And so you didn't see him often. And I think that added to his mystique.
Right.
And, you know, and you looked at him, he just looked like a fighter. He looked invulnerable. He looked like you could throw a brick at him and it would hit right on that bald head. It would do nothing. Like, that's what he looked like. And he had a bald head back when that wasn't like a fashion thing. That was like, that meant something. When you shaved your head, you were a serious badass. And just the Fu Manchu, the goatee, wearing the hat that said war. He was all about his business, all about conditioning, and a complete fighter too. Just amazing. And I learned to respect him, his skills, after his retirement. You know, I'm starting to order VHS tapes from collectors and watching these fights that I missed, fights, you know, against Mustafa Hamsho and Wilfred Scipion. And I'm like, oh, this guy was a badass, you know? But I was experienced enough as a viewer to where I could really appreciate what I was watching. So yeah, obviously news of his passing, it's like, you know, a part of my adolescence. It's like, oh,
right.
Wow, it's just gone, you know? Yeah, it's
right.
Tragic.
Definitely tragic, and definitely we send our condolences to his family and his loved ones during this unfortunate time in their lives. Dougie, once again, we appreciate you always coming on and talking boxing with us. You know, we wish you could stay a little bit longer, but I'm sure you'll be back soon, yeah, in the future. Absolutely. Anyways.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. And then before we let you go, we want to let our listeners know that the next issue of Ring Magazine will be dedicated to Marvin Hagler. Is that right?
Right. Working on it right now. Working on it right now. That'll be the June 2021 edition. And it will be a tribute to the marvelous one.
And you guys can follow Dougie on Twitter and Instagram, I believe, at Dougie Fisher. He doesn't block anybody. So
no, I don't.
So give him your all. Give him your Bring all.
It. Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for joining us, Dougie.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Dougie Fisher, man. You know, he's never dull in his words in the sport of boxing, man. He's definitely, he keeps your attention. He knows a lot of stuff. He always knows something. I'm just like, man, like, what doesn't he know about the sport? Like, I'm always surprised every time we talk to him, because I'm just like, who else knows more than this guy, right?
I know. I can't wait for the coronavirus to kind of pass. And next time we go to an event, I just want to sit down and chat to Dougie, hear his stories, have a few beers with him, and, you know, just kind of get as many of those crazy stories about, you know, people like Edwin Valero, all those guys that we know, you know, kind of before our time, but are kind of infamous.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So since Dougie had a little prior commitment, so we had to let him go a little bit earlier than usual, we'll rewind a little bit to go over the remainder of some cards that we kind of went. We're talking about at the beginning of the episode, going back to the DAZN card, Jessica McCaskill gets the 10-round unanimous decision win in her rematch against Cecilia Brækhus, the first lady of boxing, or maybe not the first lady anymore after two back-to-back losses. McCaskill retains her WBC, WBA, IBF, WBO, IBO, and a Ring Magazine welterweight titles. She's undisputed world champion at the welterweight division. What'd you think about this matchup, Mike?
I thought McCaskill was a deserved winner. I just thought she's got a very rough and ready kind of brawler style. You know, she's not your classic boxer. She's not somebody that you'd tell, you know, like a young girl, like, hey, you know, watch Jessica McCaskill. You know, you want to copy that style. You know, very much more of just a come forward brawler, but it just, it works. You know, she obviously has, you know, Cecilia Brakus's number. I don't know whether it's just, you know, Cecilia's just old in the tooth or whether it's just a clash of styles, and that style just doesn't work for Brakus. And, you know, I would assume we'll probably see her, you know, retire now.
Right.
After losing the first time, that interview that she gave kind of sounded like she was done then. But obviously, you know, she went away, kind of regrouped, went back into camp, and then obviously decided to give it a second shot. But yeah, I think that's probably the last we'll see of her.
McCaskill mentioned some names after her win. One of the names was actually Clarissa Shields, who many regard, I would say mostly all boxing fans regard as the best pound for pound female fighter in the world. But she would have to go up and weight, because I don't think Clarissa Shields would go down in weight. I mean, what do you think about that situation and that call out?
You know, if for Clarissa to come down, you know, she's got to drop a lot of weight. And then obviously, you know, if McCaskill goes up, she's kind of going up a lot of weight. McCaskill, you know, she could always go back and have a rematch with, you know, Katie Taylor, because Katie Taylor defeated her. I don't know whether Shields, I think Shields has already said that she doesn't want to drop that much weight because she doesn't want to lose a booty, I think was one of the things she said in a recent interview. So, you know, it kind of just sucks because at the end of the women's division, all the good fighters are kind of spread throughout different divisions. We need, you know, a time to come where we're going to get, you know, three or four good fighters in one weight category, so women's boxing can kind of go on to that next level. Because Katie Taylor really hasn't had a challenge apart from, you know, Delphine Pasoon, who just threw so many punches. And Clarissa Shields hasn't really had a challenge up at her weight. You know, they're very, especially up at the weights that she's at, the divisions are so low. You log on to BoxRec and there's like 9 women in the whole division.
Right.
You know, that's how shallow the pool is so far. You know, just give it a few years, let it kind of, you know, feed through. And then hopefully you'll end up like the UFC. Because if you look at, you know, Ronda Rousey, when she hit the scene, she was just annihilating girls in the first round. Somebody with Ronda's talent now in the UFC would get destroyed because it's just come on so much.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Moving on that card, Austin Amel Williams gets the 8-round unanimous decision win and remains undefeated at 8-0 over Dennis Doglin. Or is it Dolan? Hopefully I said that right.
I think it's Doglin. Yeah.
Doglin. Hopefully. Man, are you sure that's right? I don't know if that's right. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. What'd you think about Amel Williams' performance?
I thought it was good. I thought it was a really good step up for him. You know, I was surprised he took somebody of, you know, Doglin's experience in only his 8th fight. You know, Doglin's been in there with a few names over time, kind of known to be, you know, a kind of a traveled sparring partner. Spends a lot of time in Las Vegas, you know, with the dudes over at the Mayweather gym. So, yeah, good performance, you know, good for him to get those rounds in, good to get the experience against someone who's kind of like rough and ready like Doglin. So, yeah, I was, you know, presently surprised. Obviously, he's a good talent.
Terrell Geisha makes an early night of his matchup with the TK in the second round TKO over Jamonte Clark. I hope I said that right. What do you think about Geisha's early night?
I think, like we touched on, I think it was last year when he fought. Is Geisha now going to come back and be the real deal? You know, when he kind of hit the scene after the, you know, his amateur career, a lot of people were talking about him. A lot of people were very, very high on him. So maybe having that time away from the ring, you know, kind of a change in trainer and then coming back. Is he now going to be what we thought he was? I suppose only time will tell, but I thought it was a good performance. He kind of went in there, really did what he should have done. You know, went in there, everyone kind of thought he had too much experience. He was too skilled, really, to face somebody like Jamonte Clark, but he did it. You know, some people go in there and they don't do what they should do. They take the rounds and, you know, kind of slide through. Just went in there, got him out of there.
And this upcoming Thursday, going on to fight previews, this upcoming Thursday, the 18th of March, from Salinas, Puerto Rico on NBC Sports, Ring City USA. I'm sorry. I don't know. I was going about to call it Ring Magazine because I was thinking about Dougie since he was just on. Ring City USA, the new boxing programming that's been on NBC Sports. Alberto Machado, 22-2, goes up against Angel Fierro. Fierro is actually a substitution for Golden Boy fighter and Robert Garcia trained Hector Tanahara. I was, before Tanahara got an illness and had to back out from the fight, I was very excited for this matchup because this was Machado, even though he lost to Andrew Cancio out here in Indio, California at the Fantasy Springs Casino a couple years ago in back-to-back losses too. I still felt that this was a good matchup. He did move up in weight, and Tanahara, this would have been the most accomplished fighter he would have faced in his career up to this point. So I was really looking forward to this because mostly from the Tanahara perspective, because he was still a young guy. Us being media here in the Southern California area, we've been able to see Hector Tanahara kind of rise up in the ranks through Golden Boy Promotions events all around Southern California, mostly. So I'm definitely disappointed that he came down with some type of illness and had to back out. I mean, what do you think about this matchup now that Tanahara is out?
I think it really should be a win for Machado. If you look at Angel Fierro's record, a lot of fights in TJ, he's stepping in. It's a huge step up for him. How is Machado after those, couple of losses to Cancio? That's the thing you've got to see. Has he still got the fire burning? Is he going to come back, try to, reclaim another WBO title? And yeah, I was kind of disappointed, the Hector Tanahara was going to be a really good step up for him just to see, has he got the goods? It's a real big test. I'm coming out of the Robert Garcia gym. I'm sure he wouldn't be nervous going into a fight like that with all the people that he gets in the ring with at Robert Garcia's gym with, Ramirez, Mikey Garcia, host of great names. But it should be, it is a decent card though. This Ring City, they do kind of put on 50-50 fights. I think.
Yeah, they're good matchups.
Yeah, they're very good matchups. That's kind of what they've said, is anytime, any place, anywhere, I think is the motto that they have alongside the ring. So yeah, they do put on good fights for anybody that's never heard of them. Tune into, I think it's on NBC Sports.
Right. Also on that card, Marco Delgado, 7-1, goes up against Joseph Ward, 2-1. This is a rematch. Ward was injured his knee in his pro debut in October 2019. This was actually on the Triple G Derevchenko undercard. What do you think about about this rematch?
Well, he came on the show, didn't he, just before?
Debut. I believe you interviewed him as a bonus episode, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think it was either bonus or he was on with both of us over when we were in the studio. But it's kind of weird that the loss is still on his record since it was didn't happen by a punch. He took a step and his knee just gave way. And I remember Lou DiBella kind of saying afterwards he was going to campaign to have it taken off since it was just a freak injury. It wasn't caused by a punch or anything like that.
Maybe he never campaigned.
That loss is still on his record. And this is going to be the rematch for obviously, Joseph Ward try to overturn that defeat to Marco Delgado back in 2019. Joseph Ward looks good. He's had two first-round knockouts, both in Tijuana since then. So this is kind of like a step up, really back into the professional game, because some of those fights in TGA are a little bit of a joke, should we say.
A little bit of a joke. This upcoming Saturday, the 20th of March, from the Kondinka Ice Palace, what a name that is, in Moscow, Russia, on ESPN. Artur Beterbiev, 15-0, goes up against Adam Daines for Beterbiev's WBC and IBF unified light heavyweight titles. I think nobody's surprised to know that Beterbiev is definitely the odds-on favorite in this matchup. I think at this point, Beterbiev is the favorite against pretty much any 175-pounder at this moment. I mean, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody loves Beterbiev. He's 15-0, 15 KOs. We kind of, need to see a lot more of him, I think, because he's, I think he's about 33, 34 years old. He's had a few injuries lately, so he's kind of been out of the ring for some time, you know, and I think we'd love to see, you know, all the belts in the light heavyweight division kind of unified. So it'd be great to get him in there, you know, with like Bivol and some of the other big names up in that division. And surprisingly, this is actually his first return to Russia since he's turned pro. He's never fought.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's very, very surprising. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I mean, like you said, he is kind of getting on the older side, you know, 34, 35-ish. He's around that age. But he's still, at least from the last couple of times we've seen him, especially when he unified the titles in October 2019 with the 10th round TKO over the Nail. You know, he obviously looked very dominant and, you know, like he still has a lot left in the tank. So we'll see how he goes. But, you know, with the pandemic, we've seen some fighters come back in the pandemic and, you know, they haven't been the same because they've been kind of disrupted because of the training methods, the adjusted training methods. So we'll see how it works out, but definitely looking forward to his matchup this upcoming Saturday. Also moving on from the Wembley Arena in London on DAZN, Lawrence Okolie. Did I say that right, Mike?
Yep.
15-0 goes up against Christoph Glowacki. I can never say his name. Glowacki? Yep. Glowacki? Glowacki. How do I say it?
Glowacki.
Glowacki. For the vacant WBO cruiserweight title. What do you think about this matchup?
Hope, you know, obviously being a Brit, I'm hoping, you know, Okolie takes home the world title because just his story is unbelievable. You know, 2012, he's working in McDonald's, weighing approximately 300 pounds. He sees Joshua win medal at the Olympics, decides he wants to go to the gym. Fast forward 8 years, and now he's in the ring for the WBO Cruiserweight World title. What a story, you know, it's just unbelievable, really.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll see how that matchup kind of turns out. Moving on that card. I wonder if we skipped anything. I know we're trying to go back here. I'm just trying to make sure we hit everything since we did have to let Dougie go a little bit earlier, but I believe we're okay. Also on that card, Chris Billiam Smith. I hope I said that right. I'm not on a roll tonight, Mike. This sucks. Goes up against Vasil Dukar for the vacant WBA Continental Cruiserweight title. What do you think about this matchup?
Don't know too much about Vasil Dukar. Obviously, he's 9-3-1. You know, Chris Billiam Smith goes in at 11-1. Billiam Smith's been in with, you know, some good competitors in and around his way. You know, Richard Riakpar, obviously, good fighter. He's in the same gym as, you know, Shane McGuigan. Some good domestic fights against people like Tommy McCarthy in the future. I think really this should be a fight for Chris Billiam Smith to look good, pick up, you know, a WBA trinket, get himself into the rankings like everyone seems to do. And, you know, really, I would like to see him in there with some more of the domestic level guys and then work his way up because there's just a lot of names, you know, at the cruiserweight title in the UK. You know, Callum Johnson's kind of been on the sidelines for a while. He's, you know, been in there with Better BF. Maybe he has to come back down, have a few domestic or European level fights and then step back up. A fight against someone like him would be good for Billiam Smith, but would Johnson want to drop down that far? Probably not.
Moving on that card, Anthony Fowler, 13-1, goes up against Jorge Fortea for the WBA International Super Welterweight title. What do you think about this matchup?
Should be a win for Fowler, really. I've looked at Forte's records, kind of a load of nobodies in there. Apart from
is he a TJ fighter?
Yeah, not TJ, but, you know, close. You know, it's to be fair to him, though, he did go 12 rounds with, it's pronounced Muratayev, who's obviously, you know, a good fighter, another one of those Eastern Europeans. He's got a good, you know, boxing IQ. He's been in there with like a kind of like a weird, some good names, some terrible names. But I think this is another kind of opponent made for, you know, Anthony Fowler to look good. You know, Fowler's already spoken about kind of trying to face someone like Sergio Garcia after this fight. So, you know, even he's kind of looking past this. Be good to see how much Fowler's come on. He has kind of very a herky-jerky, awkward style. So I'm not a big fan of watching Fowler, to be fair.
I thought you were. I thought when we've touched on his bouts in the past, I thought you were a fan.
I just don't like his style. I like the fact he goes in there and, you know, he kind of gives a lot. He gives it his all. He tries to get rid of people. You know, like when he was in there with Scott Fitzgerald, that was a good fight to watch. But just Ray has that kind of like weird, like amateur style where he's constantly kind of moving his arm and herky jerky, you know, very wide stance. No, I'm just not a fan of that that style.
Touche. I get it, Mike. And then going back to the Virgil Ortiz Maurice Hooker main event on DAZN in Fort Worth, Texas, actually. You know, I know we talked about it with Dougie, but I know Dougie did pick Ortiz in this, and it's not that I disagree with that, but I think Hooker has more of a chance than people think. You know, just because he was a former world title holder at 140 pounds. Like Dougie said, he went over across the pond to win the title against Flanagan. And even against the unification matchup against Jose Ramirez, who is a stablemate of Virgil Ortiz Jr. Hooker and Ramirez were going back and forth. Like there was a competitive matchup up until Ramirez pretty much overwhelmed him and got the stoppage. It wasn't like Hooker was getting outmatched or anything. Hooker was in the fight. I think this is a lot closer than people think. I think Ortiz, obviously, with his knockout streak and the power and just him rising up the ranks and the hype he has behind him, in a sense, is getting a lot of attention, which is, I don't disagree with. He might be the slight favorite, but I don't know, man. Would you get mad at me if I say I think Hooker pulls it off?
I wouldn't get mad at you, but...
What?
That's kind of reaching. I think... personally, I think...
Hooker.
Is it? I think he is just too much.
It's just too much. I mean, I don't know. I just think that I've seen some Twitter messages and stuff like that, some tweets and stuff like that, kind of writing off. I don't want to say writing off Maurice Hooker, but I think his first fight at 147, and then, I mean, I know Virgil Ortiz has had a couple fights at 147, but he hasn't fought the caliber of Maurice Hooker. I think this is a very intriguing matchup. I'm definitely looking forward to this. Including the Tanahara Machado bout that obviously changed. I was looking forward to both of these matchups the most this month and this weekend, you know, primarily. So I hope that nothing changes from today as we're recording this episode till Saturday between Ortiz and Maurice Hooker. But I mean, Am I wrong? Should I change my pick here, Mike?
I think Virgil is just too big, too powerful, too strong. I think it'll kind of be a similar style. I think with Robert Garcia already going up against him with Ramirez, I think Virgil will try to kind of like cut the ring down, get him back onto the ropes, kind of like Ramirez did against Hooker. You know, Hooker has a long reach, but doesn't have a lot of power. You know, I know that a lot of people kind of class him in the same kind of group as, you know, Crawford and Jamal Herring, because those guys are all friends and, you know, train together. They're all a big band of brothers, I guess. But, you know, he's had a few fights where he's looked good, and then a few fights where I don't know whether it was cutting the weight and stuff like that, where he kind of looked kind of slow, ponderous, kind of has like one speed. Whereas I think Virgil really is just getting better and better every time you see him. You know, he goes in there, does the job. He's heavy-handed. He's had some unbelievable sparring. He's gone to, you know, trained with Joe Diaz. I saw him in there with, you know, people like Marcelino Lopez, Luca Matisse. And then he goes to Robert Garcia. He's in with a whole host of world-class, you know, competition there. I think it's going to just be another name on his resume. I think Virgil knocks him out.
I mean, it's not that I don't disagree with that. I don't know. I like Maurice Hooker. I even picked him in the Jose Ramirez fight. But
it seems like a cool guy. You know, when he's interviewed, it seems like real laid back, just kind of like a man of the people. Everyone kind of, I think he's going to one of those guys that's hard to kind of hate.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that either, but like just based on his talent and his, you know, work ethic and how he fights. Like, I think he definitely has a chance. You know, obviously Ortiz is dangerous, but you know, Hooker is more experienced in big fight situations and it has been a world champion. And it's not like Hooker, I wouldn't say Hooker at this point is over the hill in his career. But we'll see. This is definitely an intriguing matchup that I'm definitely looking forward to. Rounding off that DAZN card, Annabelle Ortiz, 31-3, puts up her WBA minimum weight title against Sunisa Estrada of Golden Boy Promotions, 19-0. And Estrada has been looking for a world title shot at this weight class for a while now. Her biggest win was obviously, I would say, and you tell me if you disagree with me, against Marlon Esparza out here in Indio, California at the Fantasy Springs Casino. What do you think about this matchup, Mike?
Looking forward to it. I like Estrada. I like her style. She's kind of, you know, very flamboyant the way that she fights. She kind of drops her arms. You can see that obviously she grew up watching Roy Jones Jr. Yeah, looking forward to it. I think, you know, Estrada should pick up a minimum weight title. I was surprised that she was 28 years old.
Estrada?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's young. Yeah. I knew that.
I thought she was younger.
It's because she's been, she's kind of been around for quite a few years. And, you know, we get more exposure to her out here in the Southern California, Los Angeles area because Golden Boy is based out here. So, I mean, maybe it's because of our access to it. So, but no, she's been around a while and she's not even 30 yet. So, yeah. You know. Why are you talking about women's ages, Mike? Come on. She's going to be pissed off at you, know.
It just surprised me. No, in a good way. I mean, I thought she was younger.
Don't try to save it now. It's over. They gotcha. They gotcha. Moving on to the news and notes section of the show. I wouldn't say this is a complete certainty yet, but Eddie Hearn did say in an interview that contracts or agreements have been signed for Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua to meet in a unification matchup. Although no venue has been secured yet, which in turn there is no site fee yet. And that still has to be agreed upon. How realistic, let me put it that way. How realistic do you think we actually see this matchup this year, Mike?
100%.
Really?
So it's too much money involved. I think both fighters want it because they want the payday. Because in the heavyweight division, just takes one. Look what happens to Joshua against Ruiz. One bad fight, one knockout. Are they going to make 200 million, 400 million over two fights? Just get it done. So too much money. Everyone gets a slice of the pie, so they're all going to try the hardest to make it happen before. You know, look what happens to people when they go and take these warm-up fights. Andy Ruiz, Josh Warrington. Josh Warrington just got laid out by Lara. It kind of makes people think, right? Is there any need to, you know, Fury goes and fights Wilder. Wilder catches him. Boom. There goes right. the big fight.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. As I'm sure in the upcoming weeks, more news is going to break about this situation. I hope it's not like, I know in 2018, there was reports that Wilder and Joshua had some type of agreement, and it was widely reported by a lot of reputable, you know, outlets, at least here in the United States. And then that never came to fruition. So, you know, hopefully it works out. But the only concern I have is that the fight will go to Dubai because of the site fee. They're gonna pay an overwhelming site fee, and it's most likely gonna go there because I don't think by the time they fight, I think they said they want to fight in July is the first fight. Yeah. I don't think by July, and I could be wrong, but by July, I mean, do you see fans coming back by then? Like in 100% capacity? I don't.
No. The first one will be, Eddie Hearn said today, June or July, probably in the Middle East somewhere. And then obviously the second fight will be November or December.
See, but doesn't that suck though? Because this fight belongs in like a Wembley Stadium, packed house.
But they can't guarantee it. You know, what happens if we get another spike and then they shut down and then there's no fans? And I think that's the problem they have, is they can't 100% say that they'll be able to get 100,000 fans. And then obviously they won't get that site fee. They don't have the oil money, you know. So the guys want to get paid. They'll do one there and then hopefully, you know, they'll do another one in.
What if they go to Florida? I mean, how long is a plane ride from London or England to Florida?
I'd imagine it'd be about around 10 hours.
Yeah, that, that's actually more than I thought. I thought it was less, but I don't know. I mean, like, obviously if the fight's going to come now, you know, there's a part of me that kind of want to say, and I can't believe I'm saying this, that like, you know, I would rather them sign an agreement for next year, but then we run the risk that it might not happen as we push it further down the line. So, you know, even if we get it like in Dubai or the Middle East, at least we get it. At least we get it. So, from a boxing fan perspective, give it to me. I'll take it. But we'll see as time goes on if this is all really viable and real. But who knows? Who knows? And like we mentioned earlier, as we wrap up the show here, our condolences and our thoughts to Marvelous Marvin Hagler's family and loved ones as he unfortunately passed away this past weekend. As Dougie mentioned, you know, it was out of nowhere. Nobody kind of expected it. Do you remember how old he was at the time?
Ooh, I think he was 62, I think.
I mean, he wasn't old at all, you know, from a comparison standpoint, but
66, sorry, it's in the notes, 66.
Right. But Hagler's career ran from 1973 to 1987, and he reigned as a middleweight champion of the world from 1980 to 1987, so about 7 years. He's remembered as one of the four kings in the sport of boxing, along with Roberto Duran, Thomas Hitman Hearns, and Sugar Ray Leonard. They all fought each other, produced some of the greatest boxing fights, the greatest fights you're ever going to see in the history of fighting. So as I mentioned, you know, thoughts and condolences to his family and friends during this difficult time. And then also this week, actually the 15th of March, yesterday, we're recording this on the 16th today, but yesterday was the birthday of Cynthia Saldana. Cynthia Saldana was the a media member here, primarily here in the Southern California area. She was a photographer for different media outlets, Supreme Boxing, the WBC. She helped out the WBC with a lot of events. She helped out other outlets. She unfortunately passed away a couple months ago from COVID. And she was, we both knew her. We met her in the boxing game along with her husband, Anthony. And she unfortunately passed away at a very young age. And, you know, we just wanted to wish, you know, wherever she's at, hopefully she's listening, a big happy birthday to her. And, you know, we wish she was here. Right, Mike, you have any parting words?
You know, obviously just our thoughts and prayers go out to, you know, her family and Anthony, who we all know very well.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you know, happy birthday. Happy birthday to Cynthia, wherever you're at, up in heaven. We appreciate it and we miss you. Thanks to Dougie Fisher, editor-in-chief of The Ring Magazine, for jumping on again here on The Last Round for the fifth time, I believe. I'm sure he'll be back soon in the next couple of months to talk more boxing, as a lot of our listeners always appreciate his encyclopedia of knowledge. But before we sign off here, Mike, go ahead and let our fans and listeners know where they can find us.
At The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And obviously join us next week. We'll be doing the big preview of the rematch everyone's been waiting for, Dillian Whyte against Alexander Povetkin.
So from my co-host, Michael Shepherd, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round